Hello to all, and welcome to the Weber Training Teleclass, Respiratory Viruses, Roles of Surfaces, Fomites, and Hands. My name is Paul Weber, and my colleague at the University of Ottawa is Dr. Syed Tatar. We are pleased to bring this entire teleclass series to you, and we are particularly pleased to have organized this particular teleclass. It's a topic in which we are both very interested. A couple of years ago, the CDC put out a document that has been like a Bible to many people in hospital housekeeping. It's called Guidelines for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities. It was co-authored by Dr. Raymond Chin and by a really smart lady whom I happen to like very much, Dr. Lynn Seehalter. Dr. Seehalter works in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. And one of the things that she is really interested in is the transmission of respiratory organisms through non-airborne routes. And that, of course, is what this teleclass is all about. So to present the teleclass, Respiratory Viruses, Roles of Surfaces, Fomites, and Hands, from the CDC in Atlanta, it is my privilege to introduce Dr. Lynn Seehalter. Lynn.
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Dr. Sitar, for being also a part of this adventure. He is a good friend and colleague, and we certainly welcome all the wonderful information coming from his laboratory there at the university. Good afternoon, or very early good morning to our conference participants today. Here we are in the midst of another respiratory virus season, so it's appropriate to revisit some of the conventional wisdom in controlling the spread of these viral pathogens. Now, I say controlling viral pathogens and conventional wisdom because when one looks at the literature, there are certainly some new studies appearing, but the bulk of the information really has not changed much from the late 80s, early 90s. It's tried and true, and what we see today are refinements of some of the basic scientific principles. In slide 2, which is titled Objectives for Today, we give you very brief points that we will focus on in today's discussion. The fundamental objective of infection control is to interrupt the transmission of pathogens. So therefore, infection control strategies are developed from an understanding of how pathogens are transmitted. And in this regard, we'll examine the roles that environmental surfaces, fomites, and hands would play in this regard with perspective for respiratory viruses. Now in slide 3, I've given you a collage of mugshots, as it were, some of the most common and troublesome respiratory viruses we encounter today. You'll see influenza virus, respiratory syncytial virus, parainfluenza virus, coronavirus, among the most common that we encounter. Other important respiratory viruses are rhinovirus and adenovirus. There's others that also have an airborne or a direct contact mode of transmission, but we will not consider them today. The viruses pictured in this slide 3 are all enveloped viruses. And as you know, the viral envelope is derived from the host cell membrane during the budding process, and it's this structural component that is an important factor in viral inactivation. Not all respiratory viruses are enveloped. As you may know, adenovirus is a good example of a medium-sized non-enveloped virus. Just as a humorous note, in the adenovirus circles, they like to refer to these virions as Cold Spring Harbor volleyballs because they do look like a soccer ball motif, and Cold Spring Harbor scientists have that as one of their favorite pathogens. In slide 4, we talk a little bit about the impact of respiratory virus infections in both healthcare settings and in the community, and we find that the impact is significant. In this slide, I've listed a few general observations. For example, in 2001, it was estimated that 5% of all healthcare-associated infections were attributed to viruses. And most infectious disease experts would consider this estimation to be very conservative. That is, it would be more of an underestimate than a true figure. The actual proportion is thought to be much higher, in part due to asymptomatic or subclinical infections. Among the population, the very young and very old of our citizens are particularly at risk for acquiring viral respiratory infections, and unfortunately there is significant morbidity and sometimes mortality in these age groups as a result. In slide 5, just a few highlights of respiratory syncytial virus infection. It's an important pathogen in pediatric circles. It accounts for significant illness among our children. Once introduced into a susceptible population, this virus does spread rapidly, so that in sero surveys, we find that sometimes greater than 95% of children are seropositive for RSV antibodies by age 2. RSV infections often lead to acute lower respiratory conditions such as bronchiolitis, pneumonia, and tracheobronchiolitis in large numbers. This virus is a very interesting pathogen. It's interesting to note that the immunity resulting from an RSV infection is not complete. This is in stark contrast to infections such as with measles virus, where the immunity is considered a complete immunity. Reinfections, therefore, with RSV are quite common. RSV in the temperate areas of the world usually occur in either the winter or the spring, but sporadic infections of RSV with RSV can occur throughout the year, but again, the outbreaks are typically occurring in the winter or in the spring. In slide 6, we highlight a few of the important facts with influenza virus, and this certainly is a pathogen that packs a considerable punch. It is also capable of causing infection throughout the year, especially in tropical climates. But widespread circulation is noted primarily from late fall through the early spring and in the temperate zones. We have three groups of influenza virus, influenza A, B, and C. And these are the three primary ones for human influenza viruses. The seasonal outbreaks of influenza are typically attributed to viruses from groups A and B. And it's estimated that approximately 10% of the population becomes infected during the flu season. Typical symptoms include fever, chills, malaise, upper respiratory symptoms to begin with. As with RSV, the pediatric and the geriatric populations are at greatest risk for severe illness. The complications and secondary bacterial respiratory infections are commonly noted. Mortality rates can be high, with anywhere from 10,000 to 50,000 persons dying from influenza and its complications. The phenomenon of antigenic drift, which is noted for the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase surface proteins, accounts for the appearance of new strains of virus each year. However, every 30 or so years, there's an abrupt appearance of new types of these surface proteins, a phenomenon we call antigenic shift. An antigenic shift results from genetic reassortment, presumably from co-infections with differing influenza virus, such that at least one of the surface proteins exhibits a new antigenic subtype compared to previously circulating strains. Shifts are associated with the emergence of pandemic influenza viruses. The reason why the current activity around the world attributed to avian influenza virus A, H5N1, is being watched very closely because the world is way overdue for its next pandemic influenza, and this virus has the potential to become a pandemic virus once it acquires the ability to pass easily from human to human. in slide 7, we have the consideration of how respiratory viruses are transmitted. Respiratory viruses are typically found in high titers in respiratory secretions that are released or discharged from the nose or mouth as large or small droplets via coughing or sneezing or talking. Infections begin when the virus comes into contact with mucous membranes, primarily those of the upper respiratory tract. Mucous membrane contact with large droplets may occur within 3 feet or so of infected persons, and this is considered a form of direct contact. Typically, these large droplets will fall out of the air quickly because of their size. Smaller droplets of diameter less than 5 micrometers may remain suspended in the air for a short time, such that they may permeate the airspace of a room, probably not going much further than approximately 6 to 12 feet. However, this is not exactly considered to be an airborne mode of transmission, because a true airborne agent will remain suspended in air for long periods of time on what we call droplet nuclei, and these can be disseminated away from the space occupied by the infected person. So there is a distinction between the large and small droplet mechanisms with transmission versus the true airborne transmission that takes advantage of droplet nuclei. And this is a distinction which is continuing to be evaluated as more research is done on transmission. In slide 8, we give examples of circumstances that have facilitated the spread of respiratory virus infection, and I also have a few bacterial infections listed there, as this was from another presentation. These are some of the respiratory pathogens we might encounter in healthcare settings. All the coughing and sneezing releases large numbers of virus into the occupied space and the environment. Whether or not we become infected, however, depends on a number of factors, factors that we commonly refer to as the chain of infection. Now, in slide 9, here are the major links in that chain. The chain of infection concept was first proposed by Dr. Willie Green back in the late 1960s to describe the elements of a successful transmission of an infectious agent. The 5 links in this chain are: number 1, the presence of a virulent pathogen; number 2, sufficient number of this pathogen, the equivalent of infectious dose; number 3, a susceptible host; number 4, a mode of transmission; and number 5, the correct portal of entry. All of these elements must be in operation for a successful infection to take place. You eliminate any one of these elements, and you have a successful interruption of transmission. In slide 10, we are talking about environmental surfaces. We're going to approach this discussion first in looking at how contamination may be present in the environment, and then secondarily, how we can prevent that from moving from point A to point B. So in slide 10, we have the environmental surfaces. As I mentioned earlier, respiratory viruses are discharged into the occupied space and the environment with each cough or sneeze from an infected person. We know these viruses will be present in the air for a short time, but after a time, they'll obey the law of gravity, and these predominantly large droplets, some small droplets, will settle out onto environmental surfaces. The question is, how important are these surfaces to the transmission of infection? This slide provides our current perspective on the role of inanimate objects and surfaces. environmental surfaces and items can become contaminated with respiratory viruses and bacteria. And in that sense, these surfaces may serve as reservoirs for these pathogens. The surfaces, however, are not directly involved in the transmission of these pathogens because, as a general rule, I know this is going to sound strange, but we don't have direct mucous membrane contact with these surfaces. So there has to be more of a transferal mechanism taking place that moves contaminating material from a surface to a susceptible person and going through the correct portal of entry. In slide 11, I just review for you the Spalding classification of medical device surfaces. And this is a classification scheme that I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with. In the early 1990s, two of my CDC colleagues, Dr. Martin Favero and Walter Bond from CDC, proposed a modification to Dr. Spalding's classification to distinguish environmental and equipment surfaces from those of medical devices. The categories of critical, semi-critical, and non-critical are descriptors we tend to reserve to that describing the medical device and instrument surfaces, the items which have usually direct contact with the patient. Environmental and equipment surfaces are set apart from this assignment, mainly because these surfaces do not ordinarily come into direct contact with patients. And so they are they're a modification of the classification that better delineate the role of these surfaces in the grand scheme of infectious disease transmission. Now, slide 12 is an interesting slide because I finally got to the point where, you know, I need to summarize these in a very simple fashion. How long does it live? We get this question quite a lot at CDC, and I'm sure Dr. Sitar and his group get this as well. We prefer not to dwell on this issue when developing infection control strategies, but it is worth discussing very briefly for the purpose of evaluating a pathogen's ability to withstand environmental pressure such as temperature, relative humidity, drying, things of that nature. This slide lists some of the pathogenic agents with short periods of persistence. You'll note that many of the respiratory viruses of interest are listed here, such as RSV, rhinovirus, parainfluenza viruses, SARS-CoV. Many of these envelope viruses have limited resistance to environmental factors. Nevertheless, some of these agents can retain activity, again, depending on the environmental factors, for up to approximately 5 days. So there is some persistence, even though some might consider that a short period of persistence. In the next slide, slide number 13, the continuation of the question, how long does it live? We list pathogens that exhibit considerably greater levels of persistence. They're present on surfaces for longer periods of time. Of these, the most notable among the respiratory pathogens is influenza virus. Now, I like to think that this virus does have the ability to withstand drying to some degree, and I would like to think that it has something to do as well with the fact that one of the main reasons we see influenza circulation in the winter months is its transmission is facilitated to some extent by low relative humidity that we find in our indoor spaces. So there does seem to be perhaps some ability of this virus to resist drying to some degree. We can lessen the role of surfaces as pathogen reservoirs by developing a reasonable strategy for cleaning these surfaces on a timely basis and disinfecting them as appropriate. In essence, by doing this, we eliminate one of the links of the chain of infection by reducing the numbers of virulent pathogens that may be present on these surfaces. In slide 14, we have the scheme of relative resistance levels among microorganisms. Now, when we talk of cleaning and disinfection, there are several factors to take into account. Cleaning products basically function to reduce or remove soil and organic material from a surface or a substrate, whereas disinfection is used to inactivate what pathogenic microorganisms may remain after a cleaning process. The choice of disinfectant depends on a number of factors, one of which is this intrinsic resistance of a pathogen to chemical inactivation. This slide, this schematic, depicts several classes of microorganisms and ranks them according to their intrinsic level of resistance. You'll note that lipid-containing or medium-sized viruses are among the most susceptible of the healthcare-associated pathogens. Viral envelopes contain lipid, and many respiratory viruses will fall into this category. Now, one of the factors that lipid moieties play in the role of chemical inactivation is this chemical maxim that likes dissolve likes. And so if you have a chemical that is basically an organic chemical, it will have a greater properties for dissolving cellular or, in this case, viral components that have lipid present in them. So this is one of the reasons why the viral envelope is a structure that is somewhat sensitive to the chemical activity of a number of our disinfectants. In slide 15, I list for you some of the other important factors to consider when choosing a disinfectant procedure. In the three basic things that you need to take into account are the chemical properties of the disinfectant available for use, the materials compatibility of the surface being treated, and the use conditions that are important to the success of the process. In slide 16, where we talk about low-level disinfection, as we have seen from the resistance diagram, respiratory viruses should be very sensitive to many of our disinfectants. Low-level disinfection inactivates vegetative bacteria, some fungi, medium to large viruses, and viruses with lipid-containing envelopes. In the second bullet, you see just some general chemical categories that are classified as a low-level disinfectant chemical. Respiratory viruses that may be present on environmental and equipment surfaces can be successfully inactivated through the use of low-level disinfection. And this process is commonly used for surfaces that have minimal degrees of contamination. This is probably the process that most healthcare facilities will be using most often for the vast majority of their housekeeping and environmental surfaces. In slide 16, we talk a little bit about, slide 17, we talk a little bit about intermediate level disinfection. The chemicals that are used to achieve intermediate level disinfection have considerably more potency that are capable of, the chemicals are capable of inactivating agents with greater intrinsic levels of resistance. Certainly all of the chemicals, such as the chlorine-containing compounds, alcohols, iodophores, some phenolics, all of these will be able to inactivate envelope viruses, such as the respiratory viruses. But typically what you'll see in healthcare is that this level of potency, we usually target to blood and body spill management rather than the routine disinfection of pre-cleaned surfaces. So while certainly this is an option, the greater amount of potency in the chemicals can be targeted for a situation that requires either a greater amount of organic material to inactivate, or you have viruses that have greater intrinsic levels of resistance. In slide 18, this is the fun one. This illustration gives you an idea how easily contamination can be spread around from surface to surface, possibly to patient and or healthcare worker, during the delivery of care. Cleaning environmental surfaces and disinfecting them, if needed, is an infection control element performed at the end of care and at the end of the day. What you will see in slides 19, 20, and 21 are the basic recommendations that I have pulled from the document that Paul had mentioned, the Guideline for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities. And we'll go through this very, very briefly. It's there primarily for you to take back to your settings and add to your notebooks and so forth. These are the general strategies for cleaning and disinfecting the large environmental or housekeeping surfaces and the surfaces of medical equipment. We have a few points to remember in this regard. First, cleaning is a necessary first step in the process to manage these surfaces. If you'll take a look at the labels of most, if not all, of the proprietary disinfectants you purchase from your suppliers, you'll see that the chemicals are best used on a pre-cleaned surface. In the next slide, slide number 20, the surfaces that have the greatest potential to become involved in pathogen transmission are those that are touched frequently by hand, either by the patient or by the healthcare worker during the delivery of care. These are surfaces such as bed rails, other surfaces in the immediate vicinity of the patient, surfaces in the patient's bathroom, and so forth. Paying particular attention to cleaning and disinfecting of these items is very important. In the next slide, medical equipment surfaces are sometimes touched during the delivery of care. These items do present a unique challenge for infection control strategies. Sometimes these pieces of equipment are not easily cleaned or disinfected, and the reason for this is primarily because they are engineered in a way that they are not impervious to fluids. They have electronic components. They have a complex design such that they have cracks, crevices, nooks and crannies. A computer keyboard is a good example of something. For something which does pose a problem for cleaning and disinfecting using liquid chemicals, it may be prudent to consider devising a protective barrier covering for such equipment. For all surface disinfecting processes that use proprietary disinfectant chemicals, it is important that you follow the label instructions for the proper use conditions, including contact time. Merely wiping the surface with a disinfectant and letting it dry may not be the process recommended by the chemicals manufacturer. In slide 22, I wanted to take a moment to comment on some current thinking with regards to environmental surface management with avian influenza virus. This is an emerging viral pathogen. It is, in a sense, so new that you will not likely find it listed as a specific agent on a disinfectant label where the manufacturer would make a claim for its specific inactivation. This is because the availability of the agent in a variety of laboratories is not as widespread as it will be someday. Those studies are underway, but they're not finalized at this point. So in the interim, what are we to do? How are we to approach this? Well, in general, my thinking is that although the antigenic identity of the avian influenza virus differs from that of human influenza virus, to date, I haven't seen anything which tells me that the overall biophysical and biochemical properties of the virions, the avian influenza virus, I haven't seen anything that would tell me that it has changed dramatically compared to those of the human influenza viruses. Avian influenza virus will still be an enveloped virus. Consequently, we would expect this virus would exhibit similar intrinsic levels of resistance to chemical inactivation as compared to that for the human virus. So therefore, until we're hearing something different, the general approach to cleaning and disinfecting surfaces as we currently use is that which would most likely be used during the time when influenza due to avian flu virus is in circulation. In slide 23, we're shifting our focus now from the surfaces to the mechanisms that introduce the contamination to those surfaces. And that is the cough and the sneeze and the runny noses and everything else that release respiratory secretions. As some of you may be aware, there is a revision to CDC's isolation guideline that is in the final stages of preparation. And one of the concepts proposed in this document is that which is called respiratory hygiene and cough etiquette. So as we find we're looking for strategies to reduce the amount of contamination on environmental surfaces, the process of respiratory hygiene cough etiquette is certainly one way to do this. The strategy can also help to reduce the concentration of virus and droplets in either the interpersonal airspace, the space for approximately 3 feet between people in conversational stance, or in the occupied space of a room. The two basic elements of respiratory hygiene and cough etiquette are to contain respiratory secretions and discharges by covering the nose and mouth when coughing or sneezing, and performing hand washing or high-end hygiene on a consistent basis. And get people to do those two things. We've got a good chance to keep the amount of contamination in the environment down to a minimum. In slide 24, another way to help minimize spread of pathogens that might be present on surfaces from one place to another is the use of personal protective equipment. Personal protective equipment can help to prevent mucous membrane contact and hand contamination with respiratory secretions. And in some instances, the use of masks, gloves, gowns, etc. are indicated during care. The types of PPE and their use is dictated primarily through an examination reviewing the elements of standard precautions and droplet precautions as needed. Not all situations would demand the use of masks and gowns, but gloves are certainly a very, very consistent element of standard precautions, and so that is one thing certainly you'll find quite commonly in healthcare. The use of respirators such as N95 respirators, not anticipated to be used routinely during care, but there are circumstances where the use of this protection is indicated, such as in doing procedures that would generate small particle aerosols, such as bronchoscopy, or when antiviral therapy is administered with the use of a nebulizer. So there are some indications for this level of PPE during the delivery of care. one of the documents, which is an excellent overview of appropriate PPE for delivery of care to persons with respiratory virus infection, is the CDC HCPCS guideline for preventing healthcare acquired or healthcare associated pneumonia. And you'll note the discussion in the document includes specific measures for the major viruses, such as influenza, respiratory syncytial, parainfluenza, and adenovirus, and the like. So it's an excellent document to review for the particulars of personal protective equipment. In slides 25 and 26, we all know that healthcare workers can acquire infections sometimes from their patients, and the healthcare workers can also acquire illness from persons they encounter in the communities. So we are in a campaign to convince people that when they are ill with an infectious disease, such as influenza, it's important to stay home when you're sick. In the next slide, the one key element to total infection control strategy for preventing transmission of respiratory viral infections is hand washing and hand hygiene. It is a simple process to do. It interrupts the transferal of pathogens from surface to surface, from surface to patient, from patient to healthcare worker. It is so basic and so important, we'll spend basically the rest of the time we have commenting on the importance of this healthcare process. In slide 27, there is a fair amount of literature from early studies in Europe with Dr. Semmelweis through contemporary studies that support the usefulness of hand washing and hand hygiene. Modern-day antiseptic hand products enhance the success of the practice in reducing transmission, so it is certainly a very strongly evidence-based process, and we cannot recommend it strongly enough. It is something that we wish that more people in healthcare would do, and hopefully we will see improvements in the compliance rate for this process. And as a matter of fact, in slide 28, there is some evidence that improvements in compliance with hand hygiene and hand washing is actually occurring. This slide summarizes the findings in a number of recent surveys of compliance that were done in a variety of hospitals and a variety of care settings. Now, one thing is true. The ones in this slide all predate the 2002 release of the HCPCS guideline for hand hygiene in healthcare settings. Nevertheless, it's important to note that infection control professionals have encouraged throughout the years the routine use of either hand washing or hand hygiene, such as with alcohol-based hand rubs. And I think you are seeing evidence that compliance among healthcare workers is increasing, so their effort in education is paying off. Additionally, there's encouraging news with the move to place alcohol hand product dispensers throughout hospitals that would keep the hospital within code for, say, fire safety and hazardous chemical regulations. So the communities with the engineers and the facility managers are also working to make hand hygiene products readily available to the workforce so that the practice can be readily done. In slide 28, this slide summarizes slide 29. This slide summarizes the two basic recommendations for hand hygiene during the delivery of care. The HCPCS guideline outlines hand washing and alcohol-based indications for a variety of clinical situations, such as before patient contact, after touching the patient's skin, after glove removal, before catheter insertion. These are to name just a few. There are a few more which are unique situations that healthcare facilities may or may not encounter. Hand washing with soap is also recommended after using the restroom and before eating. So that is a unique recommendation for hand washing alone, not the use of the alcohol products. When doing hand washing for, say, after restroom use or before eating, the guideline indicates that either plain soap or an antimicrobial soap may be used. Now, the authors of that guideline never meant to eliminate hand washing through the use of alcohol-containing hand products by any means. And it is interesting that there are new studies coming out which do support the periodic inclusion of hand washing during the day in conjunction with the use of alcohol-based products. We find that the combination of the two can minimize any loss of potency through repeated use of the alcohol products, as was described in one paper that examined the potency of several products in a challenge to a non-envelope virus that was artificially placed on the hands. In slide 30, we have a graphic that illustrates the general efficacy of the major groups of hand hygiene products, primarily for the inactivation of bacteria, usually the transient flora of the skin. A number of studies that are summarized in part one of the HCPAC hand hygiene guideline discuss the pros and cons of using the different products and generally provide you the evidence that support the benefit of using the alcohol-based hand rub in the delivery of care. In slides 30, 31, 32, and 33, these next three slides, these are some of the observations about hand hygiene technique and the time actually spent performing hand hygiene and some of the benefits of using the alcohol-based products. In general, hand hygiene as a process, the technique itself, should be something that we are all very, very familiar with. But I'm sure many are aware that if you do this right, if you do it according to everything you've been told, it takes a great deal of time. In slide number 32, you'll see that there were a number of studies, in this particular one from 1997, which is highlighted, talks a little bit about the time spent in doing several episodes of hand washing within an hour and several episodes of using a hand hygiene product, an alcohol-based rub. And basically, what you see is that use of the alcohol-based product for those seven episodes took one-third the amount of time compared to the time spent with hand washing. If it takes too long, compliance may go down. If it is something that is easily done and done quickly and built into a busy day, you'll see compliance begin to go up. Other factors that facilitate the acceptance and use of alcohol-based products include their ready availability throughout a facility and less irritation and drying of the skin. In slide 34, we've come a long way in improving the overall compliance with hand hygiene recommendations. But there is a need to continue the education and encouragement process for our healthcare workers. Again, hand hygiene and washing is probably the single most important infection control process we have available to us to interrupt the spread of infections. It is an extremely simple process. but it's some that sometimes is overlooked and is not done as thoroughly, as completely as we would like. In slide 35, we've spent a great deal of the time for this hour, again, emphasizing the importance of hand hygiene, but let's recap the main prevention measures that we use to interrupt the transmission of respiratory viruses. These would include, again, strict adherence to infection control policies and practices, avoid working while sick, personal protective equipment as appropriate, respiratory hygiene, cough etiquette encouraged for patients and visitors within the hospital, hand washing, hand hygiene, things of this nature, cleaning and disinfecting environmental surfaces as appropriate. One thing which I did not speak much of, because again this was more of a focus of management of environmental surfaces and the elements involved in that management, was vaccination and antiviral therapy. Now clearly vaccination is incredibly important, especially for influenza virus, because it is one means to safely reduce the numbers of susceptible persons in a population. So that breaks that link in the chain. If you have a population that is immune to an agent in circulation, the numbers of infections presumably will go down. Antiviral therapies, however, will help to reduce the amount of virus that can get shed onto environmental surfaces by helping to shorten the duration and severity of the illness. So these two have adjunct ability to, again, help us in our environmental control of these agents, but again, these are more therapies and immunizations as opposed to something you do really after the fact. And finally, I'd like to close with a quotation that I've listed here in slide 36, coming from a German infectious disease researcher and epidemiologist. If you read through his quote, you'll see that the point he's making is that we should not really place all of our emphasis on control simply on the chemical treatment of environmental surfaces, but rather we should consider cleaning and disinfection as simply one of the components to a successful multi-component approach to infection control. It is an important element, one that certainly will not drop out of the picture, but to rely strictly on the chemical control of agents in the environment will not be as successful as the comprehensive approach that involves controlling the discharge of contamination to surfaces, controlling transferal of pathogens by hand, and so forth. The cleaning and disinfection of surfaces is helpful to reduce the reservoir capacity of the environment, but if we can keep pathogens from coming to that reservoir, that's an important step. And finally, in slide 37, which is the last of my topic slides, I've listed for you several internet addresses which will take you to either the full text documents of some of the guidelines that I've mentioned, or highlight some other resources that would be currently of interest to issues such as pandemic influenza, hygiene practices that might be appropriate for the home and things of that nature. And as I mentioned before, we are certainly eagerly awaiting the publication of the revision to the CDC HCPAC isolation guideline, which the last time I had heard was probably due for publication late in 2006. I think things are moving to the point where it will be submitted to the MMWR for final editing sometime by mid-year. So no doubt its release will be highly publicized. I would suggest looking in your infection control publication resources later in the year for some announcement. And then it will be available either through CDC's website or through that of the MMWR. And it will be a document that I know is eagerly awaited. It has a lot of good information, particularly dealing with some of the concerns involving multi-drug-resistant organisms and emerging pathogens and issues such as pandemic influenza. And so with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and we'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Well, Lynn, thank you very much. The teleclass lecture you gave, I think, last year is still one of our most popular downloads from recording library. I suspect this one is going to be right up there as well. And very good information, as always, and, of course, very well presented. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
My question is on one of the introductory slides, on slide 8. Just looking at the list of organisms that were listed there for airborne droplet transmission, and Staph aureus is listed there. I think I get the idea of the cloud healthcare provider, the cloud adult with a upper respiratory infection like rhinovirus or something,
mm-hmm.
and possibly dispersing Staph aureus if they're colonized with it while they're coughing or sneezing.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted it to be clarified that are we saying that Staph aureus is transmitted by droplet because of cloud adults, and how does that relate to patients who are coughing and sneezing and have Staph aureus?
I think there is a limited contribution of Staph aureus in this regard. This seems to be a situation that is unusual. It is not a frequent encounter, but there have been some episodes described in the literature where certainly the nares is one of the sites that we do find colonizing Staph aureus. And we do shed some of that in nasal discharges, perhaps with blowing our nose and so forth. But if you have a viral upper respiratory infection, it's been noted that just that viral phenomenon of, again, discharge of the nasal secretions and so forth facilitates the release of, it is an unusual situation, and I would say it's more of the exception rather than the norm.
Oh?
Thank you for your informative talk, Dr. Sahulster. I have two questions. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes. First, did you find or do you know whether metal surfaces are microbicidal? This has been thought to be for many years. And secondly, I really believe we have to mix both the alcohol hygiene and not dispense without the sink. I use a lot of alcohol in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and even though my hands look clean, I will then wash with soap, and I'm always amazed at the dirt that comes away from my hands. And I wonder whether anybody's cultured this, or whether it's sterile dirt, sterilized by the alcohol or what.
I'm not aware if they've done that experiment, but I would certainly be supportive of any effort to do hand washing. I tend to support the gold standard technique myself. One thing which I keep thinking is alcohol is a chemical that will inactivate the transient flora, but it takes the use of surfactants to get the dead bodies off your hands. So that's why I do encourage people to do hand washing periodically throughout the day. It's interesting your comment about sinks and so forth. When the hand hygiene guideline came out, one of the things we started hearing from engineers and architects of healthcare facilities that were scheduled for construction was, can we do away with the sinks? And we said, absolutely not. Do not do that. They were thinking that the alcohol products could eliminate the use of sinks in the exam rooms, and we tried to dispel that notion quite quickly.
About the microbicidal properties of metal surfaces, if the does it matter if a metal surface is contaminated as opposed to a synthetic surface, the rates of dying of the organisms? Do you have any comment there?
Not specifically like for steel or aluminum or things of that nature, but if you're talking silver or some copper complexed items, there are some studies that are done that are suggestive that some ion impregnated materials will have antimicrobial properties, but again, I think those are things that need to be evaluated perhaps more thoroughly. I've not seen a lot of that material go mainstream, as it were, so I would kind of reserve judgment on that for now.
I note this presentation focuses on respiratory viruses and their transmission.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any up-to-date current information on the relative importance of the different routes of transmission of respiratory viruses, specifically influenza, i.e. small and large particle aerosol versus direct and indirect contact?
Well, one of the things that you will see is a good point of discussion is in the revised isolation guideline. Again, more of a discussion of this this intermediate space, not the interpersonal space so much. I think the large droplet spread with influenza is certainly, in my mind, still the major route of transmission for influenza. But there is some discussion in this new guideline about the ability of on small droplets to permeate the airspace in, you might say, the immediate vicinity, say 6 to 9 feet of infected persons. So this is something which I think has been a new point of discussion, which I think will be very interesting to evaluate for transmission of viruses as we look at how new agents are spread. And it's something that I think has been a very exciting thing to look at. Certainly, I would want to comment that there was at one point some interest in declaring influenza as an airborne virus. And I think the influenza community basically said no. It is not considered an airborne virus.
Before we close, let me say thank you to you all for joining the teleclass today. A special thanks to Dr. C. Hulster for her time and extraordinary talent.
You're welcome.
This has been very helpful information. Until we meet again, everybody, goodbye.